Our next speaker, I've known her for a very long time, Monami Malik. She is the executive director and founder of DRUM, fantastic organization that says rising up and moving. And she has an incredible important initiative. She is now organizing in the process, or perhaps she has organized an international delegation that will tour and look at the U.S.-Mexican border and the war that is going on there. And we do know under the Obama administration, even I believe more so than under the Bush administration, the previous administration, over 1 million or 1 million undocumented workers and who have come here have in fact been deported, and that's a Democratic administration for you. So we welcome Monami Malik.
Thank you, Nelly. I'm so glad to be here. This is really an amazing, informative teach-in. Thank you for doing this. I've got some literature, some copies to hand out of recent reports by the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, a really wonderful organization that brings a global anti-imperialist perspective to the migration problems in the U.S. and around the world today. So I'll pass those out later. So as Nelly said, I work with an organization called DRUM. They Seize Rising Up and Moving. Anybody know what they see means? Some people? So they see means of our homeland in a lot of different languages from South Asia. So we are a mass membership-based organization in New York. We have members from Pakistan, Bangladesh, Guyana, Trinidad, India, Afghanistan, and Nepal, South Asians. There are about 1 million South Asians in New York, and most of our membership are undocumented workers. They're domestic workers, cab drivers, restaurant workers, retail store workers, and many of our young people are in the public schools and undocumented as well. So we work around racial justice, racial profiling issues, especially in the Muslim community since 9/11. We work around immigration, detention, and deportation, around school policing, ending to school-to-prison pipeline in our public schools, and for immigration reform. And recently, we just came back, as Nelly said, from organizing a national border delegation, the National Border Justice and Solidarity Delegation. We had about 25 organizers from around the country, including groups like Black Alliance for Just Immigration, the Alliance for Educational Justice, the ACLU, members of our organization, and members of a street vendor organization in the Bronx called Vamos Unidos, who have many members who have crossed the desert and are now in New York. And it's something you don't think a lot about until I first went to the border 6 years ago for an emergency delegation right before the Bush administration passed a border militarization bill that doubled the numbers of military and border patrol in the desert. Well, at that time when I came back, I just looked around me in a different way. I grew up in New York my whole life, but I never thought that the people you live next door to, the people you work with, the people you see every day on the streets, the struggle and the history people have come through to get to where they are, and to be treated how they are here in New York by police and immigration. But being in the desert, being in a place where thousands of migrants have died crossing, is a truly powerful experience. And if any of you are interested through your organizations or just as an individual, please let me know and I would love to help you attend such a delegation. I'm going to start off with some of the numbers that I'm not sure if folks know, but since 1994, over 4,000 bodies or remains of bodies have been found in the U.S.-Mexico border. And estimates are for every one body found, 10 are never found, which makes that a very high number, 40,000 people. And bodies are often not found in the desert because the heat is so extreme, the animals, the conditions are so bad, and the desert is so vast, and nobody's looking for these people. The deaths that are happening at the U.S.-Mexico border are not just here. They happen in borders that are militarized around the world. And in fact, some of the highest number of deaths are occurring in the Mediterranean Sea of African migrants who are going into Europe, and Europe's similar militarized border and immigration policies as the U.S., including a border wall built by the same construction Israeli construction firms that build the wall in Palestine and are building a border wall in Morocco to prevent African migrants from going to Europe and build a U.S.-Mexico border wall here. So the military aspect and profit in all of this is very clear. Let me tell you a quick story at the border. When we went last time, we were told of a story of a father who was crossing with his 12-year-old daughter, and they were chased, as often happens at nighttime, by Border Patrol vehicle. And Border Patrol vehicle ran over the young girl, killing her. And instead of any accountability for the Border Patrol actually arrested the father for endangering his daughter's life and for her murder. And he was jailed and eventually deported. These are stories that are happening every single day. And Arizona, as everybody knows, is no joke right now. To be a person of color, period, means you're going to get stopped everywhere you go, by cops, by police. We had to go through about 5 different checkpoints, not even at the border, but 30 miles from the border, where you have to show your American ID or passport or green card. So the reason that this is important, and one of the reasons we go to Arizona, as our comrades there, Isabel Garcia and the Coalición de Derechos Humanos in Arizona has been saying for years, is that what happens in Arizona is a testing ground to be perpetrated all around the country. And really, the border has creeped up all around us now. In the last year alone, last couple of years, under the Obama administration, we've had the passage of laws turning local police officers into immigration agents around the country. Now, this is something George Bush tried to do for over 8 years under something called the CLEAR Act, which he was never able to pass. But under this administration, 287G agreements have been passed around the country, which deputizes local police to become immigration agents. SB 1070 in Arizona and states around the country. And most recently, folks must have heard of the fight around secure communities. So secure communities basically puts immigration agents in every jail. So as soon as somebody's arrested, whether they're charged, convicted, or not, and you get booked by a police officer, you immediately go into a database to immigration, and immigration agents come to jails, including Rikers, and pick people out and deport them. Now, you can never have been convicted of the crime, but it doesn't matter. And thousands of people are already being deported this way. And in a lot of states, like in New York, we fought hard to get the state to retract their agreement for secure communities. And then what did DHS and ICE do? They actually announced 2 weeks ago that you don't need any agreement. This is federal law of the land. And they could do this anywhere. And states can't opt out. So this is kind of the condition we're in terms of immigration and the migrant struggle. But none of this is nothing new. However, in the last couple of years, we've seen the highest sort of levels of deportations. In 2010 was the highest year of deportations, with 392,682 deportations. In the last 2 or 3 years, we've had double the number of deportations than ever in U.S. history. The border deaths have increased. The highest number was last summer. 253 bodies were found in just one section of the border. And the highest number of detentions we've ever seen, including 104 deaths in detention custody since 2003. So again, this is nothing new in the sense of, immigrant detention, incarceration began really in 1996 under Clinton with the 1996 IRA-IRA laws. And it's what first started criminalizing immigrants and creating mandatory detention. Then you had 9/11 happen, and right before 9/11, if folks remember, there was actually a vibrant movement for amnesty. And a lot of folks thought that, it was possible, it was going to happen. Well, 9/11 really destroyed all of that, like it did a lot of other social movements. And in 2003, The U.S. government created the Department of Homeland Security out of what used to be called the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So basically, now forever, immigration is going to be equated with homeland security, national security, war, and militarization. And in 2001, the DHS, or INS at the time, released a report called Operation Endgame, which you can find online if you Google it, and it's a report that basically says within 10 years, the goals of the U.S. government is to deport everybody that is deportable from the United States. So it's not surprising then that the regime that's in place right now has been built up for a long time. And you know, a lot of folks may have heard about the struggle for comprehensive immigration reform, and you know, a lot of folks think it's a good thing we get legalization, but the reality is every CIR bill we've gotten in the last 5 years has had huge, huge sections of border militarization, which means more border deaths, more detentions and deportations, clauses around making police immigration officers, and a whole host of other bad enforcement measures. So we have actually rejected categorically many of these so-called comprehensive immigration reforms, which would lead to more detention and deportation and death. One of the global aspects also of migration that's never talked about in the U.S. and in the immigrant rights struggle in the U.S. often, at least from the folks in D.C. and our policymakers, is that we all know that migrants are here because the U.S. government is there. You know, amongst our communities, this is a clear fact, that it is wars, it is free trade agreements, it is structural adjustment policies, IMF and World Bank policies that displace people and force them to risk life, literally, in order to survive and feed their families. And that first world nations have, you know, it's a neo-colonial system where it's indentured slavery, where it's cheap, exploitable, and expendable labor. And so, you know, some of the indicators of this is that internationally, one of the main agencies that's actually deciding migration policies and border policies, you wouldn't think, but is the World Trade Organization. And at WTO meetings, there's entire sections devoted to migration, and what the WTO has been trying to promote is a global guest worker program. Now that kind of sounds familiar as to what that might entail. You know, we've had Bracero programs and other programs here before. Also, institutions like the GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, IMF, and World Bank have huge hands in controlling a global migration militarization regime that really leads to more profits for corporations and more exploitable workers. In the US right here, the border was actually, you know, the border has always been there and people have always moved across the borders. One of the communities we visited at the border was a Native American reservation called the Tohono O'odham. And they live, their lands have been on thousands of years on both sides of the border. And the Tohono O'odham now have permission to go back and forth across the border, which is also why a lot of migrants cross through the reservation. But the border was not always a place of death. This was an intentional policy of militarization, and in fact, I think it was Ronald Reagan who quoted the pre-building of the border wall, that the intention at the U.S.-Mexico border was to engage in low-intensity warfare that has been successful for us in Central America. And that was how the plans to militarize the border came about. In 1994, Operation Gatekeeper passed, which first started creating the border and creating what we call the funnel. And so basically, the border is thousands of miles long, but the wall is not everywhere. And you wonder, what's the point of that? You go along the border, and all of a sudden, the wall just ends. And then there's vast desert. So what's the point of all this? Well, the point was basically to funnel migrants into the harshest places of the desert, where people will die if they cross. And that was the purpose of the border strategy. And so these funnels have started the deaths in the way we see them now. And not surprisingly, why 1994 is Operation Gatekeeper? Because 1994 was also the year that NAFTA was passed. and the passage of NAFTA displaced over 1 million Mexican farm workers, forcing them to cross. So, you know, I just want to end up there, but some of the things I just want to reemphasize is that when we, you know, I believe that the migrant rights struggle will always continue and is part of and needs to be a part of the racial justice and anti-imperialist struggle. We organize migrant coalitions in New York called Immigrant Communities in Action, and we make sure as a multinational migrant coalition that we are always engaged in anti-war activities, and we have migrant rights delegations, we have migrant rights contingents at every anti-war rally because we understand the root causes of migration as being part of this system of war and occupation. And so we've had great sort of solidarity building and unity building across communities. The street vendors I mentioned in the Bronx did collections, and these are, you know, undocumented women who sell churros on the street on a shopping cart, and they collected and raised $2,000 in one evening to send to Palestine when the Gaza bombing was happening. And when we told our comrades in Palestine, they were just so happy that that money meant so much because it came from other people in struggle who understand displacement and CIA covert wars and who have been through that. So, you know, we stand in solidarity always with the anti-war movement because we understand wars in our home countries by the U.S., and we will always come out. And we ask also for the anti-war forces to really think and look critically at the immigration measures that are being proposed to us as a just and fair immigration reform, because underneath a lot of it are intentions to deport, criminalize, and murder more migrant workers. And just one example of that is the DREAM Act. Folks know what the DREAM Act is? Most folks do. So the DREAM Act has been, you know, hailed as the solution. It would legalize undocumented youth and students. Well, the reality is when the DREAM Act first came out, there was an option that if you are low income, you can't afford college, you can't afford to go full time, you got to drop out, you can do community service instead. Well, slowly over the years, our policy advocates in DC turned that into you can't do community service, you have to do military service. And in fact, we've had so-called immigration advocates on our side writing letters to Muslim undocumented youth telling us they should write letters to their senator saying they would be proud to serve in Iraq in exchange for a green card. You can imagine how our young people feel about that. And our young people, as undocumented Muslim South Asians, said we will never take a green card on the blood of our brothers and sisters anywhere in the world. And it's one thing for us to say that in our community, but even Latino youth have said that. And Vamos Unidos put out a national statement to the Latino Youth Dream Movement saying, we as Mexicans and Latino youth will not accept a green card on the blood of anybody around the world. And so that's the kind of solidarity we hope that, you know, builds across communities as we all try to fight to take this empire down. And I'm going to end off with a chant that we do a lot in drum. It comes from anti-colonial struggles in South Asia. So it goes, Inqilab Zindabad. Inqilab Zindabad means long live the revolution. So when I say Inqilab, you say Zindabad. Inqilab! 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 Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mon Ami. We're going to move quickly, and we're going to look at organizing in New Jersey and this incredible campaign of the People's Organization for Progress. Every day, they have made a commitment to be on the streets, talking about jobs and mass incarceration and all of the wars that are being waged against our communities. Our next speaker is going to be Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. In fact, yes, we do have a campaign for jobs every day, and in fact, we were out there today, and I'm happy to say today was day 54. We've had 54 consecutive days of protests for jobs. We started on June the 27th, but actually this discussion about what to do about the job situation in our community started actually last year. And those of you who know anything about the People's Organization for Progress, you know that we are a mass democratic grassroots organization. And we're very diversified in our opinion. There's no lockstep in POP. And we have debates that are very fierce sometimes, like the debate over President Obama that went on for 18 months in our organization. But we started talking about this last year, and I don't know how many of you are aware of it, but we have a very serious situation in Newark. You know, now the national unemployment rate is 9.1%. That's 1% away from depression level unemployment. Depression level unemployment is 10%, but in the black community nationally, the unemployment rate is something like 18%. That's almost twice depression level. In Newark, New Jersey, the unemployment rate is 22%. That's over twice depression level. And in one ward of Newark, I just got this figure the other day, one ward of Newark, the unemployment rate is 30% in the West District of Newark. Now that's the overall. If you were to segment out, for instance, black men, it wouldn't even be 50%. I know we were aghast when several years ago we heard about 50% unemployment rates. We're talking about 60, 70, 80% unemployment rates in some neighborhoods. In a country this rich, it is a disgrace to have 26 million people unemployed. It's a disgrace to have unemployment rates 50, 60, 70%. There were graduations. We got four colleges in Newark. Graduations this spring in May and June. And on the graduation days, people were happy and smiling. They were with their families. But now many of those graduates are not smiling because they've been pounding the pavement now for 3 months and can't find jobs. So we said, we need to do something about the job situation. We need to do something above and beyond what we have done historically. So we said, why don't we start a daily campaign to protest unemployment and to demand jobs in this country? And we started that campaign on the 27th of June. Now, when we started the campaign, we said that we meet every week, every Thursday POP meets. And we said we were gonna evaluate this on a week by week basis because there was not a consensus within our organization. We're not a great big organization. We don't have unlimited resources. And there was some debate within our group about whether or not we could sustain a daily campaign for jobs. So we said we would do this week by week. So after 4 weeks of daily protests, we came to the conclusion that we could sustain this, and people said, well, how long should we do this? And we began to look back at historical precedents. And in the black community, everybody always looks back to Montgomery, Alabama in 1955, to Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. And we said, if our people back then, who didn't have cell phones, rapid copiers, who didn't have iPads and all this technology, if they could sustain the Montgomery bus boycott for 381 days, we should at least be able to protest for jobs that long. And we decided in August that we would push forward with this campaign for jobs for 381 days. And what we do, we gather every day at the intersection of West Market Street and Springfield Avenue in Newark. That's in front of the old courthouse, the old Essex County Courthouse meeting. And there is a statue of Abraham Lincoln. So we said, we ain't got to go to Washington, to the Lincoln Memorial. We got our own Lincoln Memorial right here. Let's do it right here at the intersection of two of the major boulevards, two of the major traffic arteries in Newark. And so we're there every day from 4:30 to 6, Monday through Friday. Then we move two blocks to Broad and Market Street. That's where we were today, the heart of downtown Newark, from 12 to 2. And we come back on Sunday to West Market and Springfield Avenue. And what are we attempting to do? Is this just about doing this every day? No. We're trying to occupy a particular piece of territory to raise this issue about jobs. We not only want to protest for 381 days, but we want to turn the Lincoln Plaza into our own Tahrir Square and have hundreds of people out there every day. That's our eventual goal. That's our eventual goal. Right now, it's a dozen, it's 15, 20, 25 people out there sometimes on a daily basis. But what we want to do is get hundreds of people out there. And what we've come today is to ask for your support, to ask you to join us. If we were to get all of our organizations, and we have hundreds of organizations, if we would get all of our grassroots organizations, all of our churches, all of our union locals, to each take one day, we would not only be talking about the Montgomery bus boycott, we would be talking about the Newark protest movement that would catch fire not only in Newark, but maybe people in other parts of the country would replicate this. Already we've gotten calls from people in Florida, in Philadelphia, saying they want to do the same thing. And what are we protesting for? Our number one demand, we want a national jobs program. We want a new WPA. If we got trillions of dollars for war, we got enough money to put all the people who are out of work back to work. That's our number one demand for a national jobs program. But this is not just for jobs only, but for economic justice in general. So the next demand is tied right to our demand for a national jobs program. We want an end to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, and we want the trillions of dollars that are being spent on war to be spent on jobs and housing and education and healthcare in this country. Our third demand for economic justice, we want a moratorium. We want an end to home foreclosures and people being thrown in the streets. In some places in Essex County, we got the highest foreclosure rates in the state. In Irvington, New Jersey, they already have a 40% foreclosure rate in that town, and they say next year it may go as high as 80%. Can you imagine that? 80% of the homes in one town boarded up. But you can go through Irvington and Newark now and see block after block boarded up. And we need to point out, you know, we gave the banks, they're talking about the way to economic recovery. The way to economic recovery is not trillion-dollar bank bailouts, not tax breaks for the super rich. The way to economic recovery is to put the people who need to work and want to work back to work in this country. That is the way to economic recovery. And what did the grateful bankers do? What did the grateful bankers do for our trillion-dollar tax bailout? They raised their saving accounts rates. They raised their checking accounts rates. They raised the interest on their loans. They foreclosed on our homes. And they turned around to put salt in the wound, gave themselves million-dollar bonuses. We should be throwing picket lines up at all of these banks, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, J.P. Chase Morgan. We should be throwing picket lines up in all of these places. Now, our next demand for economic justice is something that you all are very familiar with. I thought was a kind of new demand, but when I went back to Why We Can't Wait by Dr. King, I see it was something that he was talking about. We want universal health care in this country so every person can get the medical attention and the medicines that they need. The other part of this program for economic justice tied to our daily protests is we want an end to the attempt to destroy public education in the United States of America. That's what's going on. If you can't see it, brothers and sisters, you are blind. What is all this stuff about charter schools and special schools and closing schools? It's about the destruction of public education. The tracking system that we have is not enough. Look, in cities all over this country, they are closing schools by the scores. They may close as many as 20 public schools in Newark this fall. And what is that going to do? That's going to overcrowd the schools that remain open. But they are not worried about, you think those people really care? They're about setting up a public education system that in the final analysis is only going to benefit them, not going to benefit us. I don't know if you know it, but free public education came out of the Reconstruction, was a creation of the black freedmen. We are not going to accept the destruction and privatization of public education. And the next demand that we have that's part of this program is that we want affordable college education for all of our young people. I don't know if you know it, but we are turning generations of college graduates into debt slaves. They're graduating with $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of loans. They'll be older than me before they can even finish paying off these loans. This country is rich enough. If Libya could provide free college education, this country should be able to provide free college education for its young people. So these are some of the demands. There are others, but these are the core demands that we are raising on a daily basis with these daily pickets. And what I'm asking for today, I'm asking for your support. I'm asking for each organization to pick a day and bring your people over. You bring your people over for our thing, and we'll bring our people over for your thing. You know, we got to get like this gangland mentality. You bring your gang, I'll bring my gang. And our gangs will reinforce and support each other. But imagine if we could get a spot in Newark where we had gathering out in the open in front of everybody, several hundred people every day. And maybe after 4 or 5 months, it wouldn't be several hundred, it'd be 500 or 600. And maybe as we got close to 300 days, it might be 1,000. It could be something unlike we have ever seen in the city of Newark. I think we can do it. I didn't know that we could sustain it on the day, but we're in day 54, and we plan to go 381 days, but we need your support. On Tuesday night, August the 30th, we are having a meeting for all organizations that want to give support to this campaign. That meeting will be Tuesday night at the Bethany Baptist Church, 275 West Market Street in Newark, New Jersey. Tuesday, August the 30th, not this Tuesday. Tuesday, August the 30th at 6 p.m. So I'm extending an invitation to all of you and representatives of as many organizations as we can get together. It's time for us to fight back. I met with a group of preachers the other morning, the South Ward Ministerial Alliance. I was invited to address them about this daily campaign. And they were trying to tell me about things. We should do legislation, and we should do, boy, and we should do this. But I tried to tell the brothers, I said, look, we're not even there yet. We're not even there where we have the political authority and wherewithal really to make a boycott successful. We're at the very beginning. What we have to do right now is break through the consciousness of our people, break through the weapons of mass destruction that have our people's minds on everything except the fire that is on their behinds. We gotta break through. We have to do bold and daring things that have not been done before in numbers that we have not had. And we can't just do them in Washington. And we can't just do them in New York. We have to do these things in the communities where our people, where our constituents live, where the people who are most likely to support us congregate and live. And in that way, we stir up the consciousness. Let me tell you, there's only been about a dozen of us every day out there. But right now, we don't even have to hold our signs up. The people drive by and they're honking their horns. They're throwing their fists out the window. They're showing us that they're in solidarity. They understand, they agree with our message. And along with this daily campaign, I want to say this. On Thursday night at our General Assembly meeting, the People's Organization for Progress voted to support the Verizon workers' strike. And all of us should be supporting the Verizon workers' strike. Not only did we vote to support the Verizon workers, we voted to adopt a picket line. They got picket lines all over everywhere. They're asking people to adopt a picket line. And along with the red shirts of the CWA, we gonna put the yellow shirts of the People's Organization for Progress out on these picket lines. And we're instructing our branches to do the same thing, so it's not just in Newark, New Jersey. This is the period that we're in, when we have to take down the walls of separation, as we've been trying to do. This is nothing new. We've been trying to do this for the last 40 years. But the urgency of the moment is upon us. The people are suffering in ways that are unimaginable. All you have to do is come to a POP meeting every week. People that we have never known before are coming to us with the most horrendous incidents of police brutality. Just Thursday night, we had a packed house. We had five representatives of the U.S. Justice Department for the first time at a meeting of the People's Organization for Progress to take testimony from the people, because we call in the Justice Department. We know that just as those old white Southern racist police forces were in cahoots with the Klan during the civil rights movement, it's the same thing in Newark, except the uniforms are not white, the uniforms are blue. And just as those Southern police forces needed federal takeover, we calling for a federal takeover of the Newark Police Department. So they were here. People are being thrown into the streets. People are being evicted. People are losing their homes. People don't have money to buy food. You can't even get a fraction at the Pathmark or the ShopRite or the A&P, a fraction what you used to get with your money. People are suffering. And we have to connect ourselves to these issues that people are confronting in their daily lives. I sincerely believe that this is what we must do. We must tie these local issues. It's one thing, we must talk to people about imperialism. But imperialism is a worldwide system. The same imperialism that is engaged in the recolonization of Africa is the same imperialism that is engaged in the immiseration of the people right here on the streets of Newark and the streets of New York City. The same way they oppress and exploit abroad is the same thing that they are doing here at home. But we have to be sharp enough, and we have to give an analysis that's clear enough so that the everyday person, the person that rides the bus, and the person that rides the subway, and the women that take their children to daycare, and the people that go to church on Sunday and go to the mosque on Friday, we must give them a way to understand this in the clearest and most simple terms. So I hope that you will support us in this effort, and we will try to continue as much as we can with the limited resources and people that we have to support you in your efforts. Thank you very much. Power to the people. Yeah. Woo.
Brothers and sisters, Larry Hamm, I mean, he certainly put a fire under me. And I hope everyone else in this room enough fire for you to want to get on the path, the train, car, bus, or however you can to join in those daily demonstrations in Newark. And while we have here Chris Gavreau, we want to say and ask UNAC to take a stand and issue a statement of support and ask its members all over this country and in New Jersey to come out and support the daily demo, it's a people's demo and in Newark, and we need that. And we need a united front, and hopefully when we talk about, I have one of the guest speakers, to talk about the Harlem Million March, it's about how we can really, really have a million march, not just here, but on the streets of Newark. And Larry, thank you so much. I hope you're not leaving, but thank you. Okay. Now, folks, we only have a little time left, but we're going to move not too quickly from Haiti to Afghanistan. And we have with us here today Raja Leduc, who is a Haitian activist. He is going to talk about Haiti, not what you hear on the news, but what you don't hear on the news. And we also have to talk about our left media and what they are doing, and how many of you have heard Amy Goodman, one of the sacred cows of media, to refer to Libya as the regime. Now, where is that coming from? And Leon Panetta on the show being interviewed as if he doesn't have enough spots to be interviewed on where people can see him. I mean, we alternative media should be about alternative media and not giving a balance to CNN. Okay. Pardon me? Oh, yeah, and Galloway as well. But anyway, we're going to ask Raja to come up and to bring us up to date on Haiti. Raja Leduc.
Good evening, everyone. It's a very hard act to follow, but gives us some energy. And we've been watching revolts, uprisings all over the world, from the young people to labor, and we're asking, where is the organized leadership? Where is the organization to rally all of this and turn it into a powerful movement? I guess the leadership is within us. We just have to recognize it. The gentleman just proved it just now when he talked to us about the struggle in Newark. I'm here to talk to Haiti, and a lot of the things that he spoke about connect very well with Haiti. Talked about imperialism, of course, you living it within the belly of the beast. In Haiti, we're really suffering the heavy boots of imperialism right now. But the irony in Haiti is like you don't hear it talked about. Whenever they ask me to speak about Haiti, I always come first and talked about occupation. Because if there is one thing that characterized Haiti's situation for the last few years, especially from 2004 on, is that Haiti's been occupied. Haiti's been occupied under a new label. They have something that they call R2P. Responsibility to protect. That's the new label. That's the new justification. That's the new pretext to occupy the country like Haiti. You have a failed state. The state cannot protect its citizens. In the case of Libya, the regime is killing its own people. We can come and invade them. So that gives us the right, even the responsibility, they're using responsibility, to go to places like Haiti and occupy. The bourgeoisie in Haiti has always very happy when the imperialists come to occupy Haiti. But we have something new in Haiti's history. It's like the middle class, most of the middle class of Haiti, by fear of the popular masters, tacitly agree with the occupation of Haiti because they need protection from the people. August 14, 1791, we had a ceremony in Haiti called the Ceremony of Wakaima. That's 220 years ago. This is what Haitians are commemorating this week, this ceremony of Wakaima. The imperialists, the Western powers and intellectuals have done a great job through the centuries of downgrading this ceremony because they said that showed why Haiti cannot go forward, why Haiti cannot progress. Because the slaves in Haiti in 1791, all the way to 1804, the year of our independence, those black slaves had made a pact with the devil to gain Haiti's independence, and that's why Haiti cannot progress. Not because the American did not recognize Haiti's independence until 1864, because Haiti, of course, was a danger. They were a slave country. Not because France made sure that Haiti was always economically dependent. Not because Germany was sending boats to Haiti to threaten and always asking for money, because the Haitians had threatened one of their citizens doing commerce in Haiti. No, it's because God doesn't want Haiti to progress, because it was through a pact with the devil that Haiti became independent. So you see, imperialism takes different forms, not the least of which the propaganda, endless propaganda and brainwashing of the world, but unfortunately, of some of the Haitian elite. Because at some point, this elite is so brainwashed. And that's what even some slave owners said in the United States. We will brainwash so many black people that we won't even have to tell them ourselves. There will be other blacks to tell them how inferior, how undeserving they are of freedom, how incapable of them that they are to handle freedom, or knowledge, or literacy. So Wakaima is what we're celebrating this week. And I'm talking about Wakaima with a good dose of humility, because we're talking about people who were victims of the worst, most brutal form of slavery. Corporal mistreatment, brainwash, raped by the woman, and they found a way to make it possible. In the night of the August 14, 1791, 200 leaders from different plantations around the north came together during the night and decided that it was enough. They called unto God to give them strength to fight against this mistreatment. They decided that they were going to burn every plantation they could burn and kill every slave master they could kill. You write about that. And they did so. For weeks, you can see the smoke coming from the plantation of Saint-Domingue. That's the way they call Haiti then. You can see it in Jamaica. You can see it very, very far away. And speaking about Jamaica, the great leader of that uprising was Bookman. He's the one who assembled all the slaves and gave them strength, gave them leadership, and made sure that they were fearless. And they were fearless. And it's through that Wakaima ceremony that you saw other leaders from who dominated the Haitian Revolution from 91 to 1804, to Saint-Louverture, Dessalines, all of the others. They came through this. And I'm talking about it through humility. Because we have it much better now. And we cannot find the fearlessness, the resolve, the unity, the love of freedom to this day to come in Haiti and build another movement. All of the speakers who came before me talked about how the empire is acting right now. The brother who spoke about Libby talked about why they are not responding to ethnic cleansing, to genocide. It's always the same answer. I know you know it, but I'll say it anyway. These people are not people to them. It's simple as that. We do not have to theorize too much to understand this. These are not people like they are people. And it's happening in Haiti. Not only vis-a-vis the imperialists. It's happening in Haiti within the class struggle in Haiti. The bourgeois in certain slices of the middle class in Haiti. Because Haiti is a semi-feudal country still. They do not feel that the Haitian masses are 100% people like them. So it's okay when the United Nations come to Haiti in 2004. It's okay for certain leaders to go to the commander of the minister troops. That's the mission to stabilize Haiti. To go to them and say, you got to go to the popular quarters, to the slums area, and make sure you put order in there, which means killing people. And even though the Brazilian commander, the first one, refused to do this, the second one refused to do the same thing. The second one committed suicide. Nobody can explain that suicide. At the end, at least according to Lancet magazine from Britain, at least 5,000 of these Haitians died through brutality from the United Nations. Some American Marines, some French Marines. So you see, the massacre in Haiti is always happening. 2004, 1991, 1915, in between that 1957, whenever the revolt comes up, the people get massacred by thousands in Haiti. It's like clockwork. So this is what we're living right now in Haiti. We are in a position where there is total domination of the Haitian political class in Haiti by the imperialists. Of course, the United States at the head of it, but France and Canada. Because the empire acts now differently. They occupy this country under the guise of United Nations mission. But they also do it gang style. It's not just one country. You have several of them. This is what's happening in Libya right now. You got several countries together, including countries like Norway, which never participated in things like this before. This is the new way of dealing with uprisings. They come to your country and occupy everything. In Haiti, They organize an election. It's not by chance that Martelly is now the president of Haiti. Haitians and Haiti had lost the election before the results were known. It doesn't matter that it was Martelly who won. It could have been Mrs. Maniga. But with Martelly, you have the degradation, materialized, personified, degradation of Haitian politics and the low level of the organized struggle in Haiti. Martelly is the guy who dropped his pants to moon the Haitian populace when they were struggling for Aristide not to be kept in exile. Martelly is the guy who was participating in the repression in 1991 and who had friends in the military in 2004. One of the greatest, one of the strongest killers in Haiti, Michel Francois, was Martelly's friend. So see, they give you the worst leader that they can give you to make sure that the domination keeps on going. And right now, because of Martelly's friendship with the black forces, dark forces in Haiti, those people under Duvalier who killed so many people, those people between 91 and 94 who killed thousands of Haitians and raped thousands of women, the same ones who killed people between 2000, after 2004, especially between 2004 and 2006, they are threatening to take power again in Haiti to make sure that the imperialist project gets established. What's the imperialist project? And what's the main arm of this project? It's something they call the Interim Commission to Reconstruct Haiti. It was organized by the United Nations and voted into law by the Haitian Parliament, together with a decree that said Haiti could be managed through a state of emergency for 18 months. That 18 months is going to be finished in October. Martelly already decided to prolong the mandate of the Interim Commission. Who is at the head of the mandate of the commission? Bill Clinton is one of the two heads of the commission. And Bill Clinton has his own foundation in Haiti. His wife is the Secretary of State, talking about conflict of interest. So this is where we're at right now. We are in danger of going back to a situation, dictatorial situation, pre-1986, while the imperialists are reinforcing their powers in Haiti. It couldn't be worse. But I think sometimes when we think it's worse, that's when we should have hope. I'm glad this young brother came before me and stated how people should fight and how we should really give it all we have. Because if they want to go back to François Duvalier and Jean-Claude, I think that's when the fight, that's where we have a chance to win the fight. Because there is one point that the Haitian masses went through. They're not going to go back to that period. So that's where I think the fight is going to be fierce. The Haitian masses, if there is something they know, that they are 100% people like everybody else. And they're not going to go back to the time when people could tell them, because they couldn't speak French, because they live in certain neighborhoods, because they have certain darkness, that they're not people like everybody else. That was the issue in 1791, and the slaves solved it. And that's the issue right now. And we must solve it. And we must solve it if we really have to solve it. We have to really find a way to unite. Unite the democratic forces and the progressive forces in Haiti. Because the enemy is too strong for us to still be in a state of being fragmented. Labor movement fragmented. Democratic movement fragmented. You have in front of you the empire. You have the bourgeoisie in Haiti. You have the intelligentsia. We cannot afford to be disunited and fragmented. And the empire, you must have realized it. And I think it's because it's weakening. The United States, through Mrs. Clinton's declaration, is becoming more abrasive, more aggressive. I heard Ms. Clinton lecture the Africans' head of state about the support for Gaddafi. This is incredible. Ms. Clinton went to Haiti during the election to give the Provisional Electoral Council orders to follow the recommendation of the OAS, which wanted Martelly and Miss Maniga as the two candidates who would go in the runoff. Ordered them. While there were trouble in Egypt, she went to Haiti personally to give the orders. Same arrogance. Incredible. While the United States is sliding and losing power. So I think if we don't wake up, when the beast is dying, like Cheney said, in the throes of agony, it may become more dangerous. And I'm asking you to believe that the Haitian masses are not dead. On the contrary, the Haitian masses are not dead. Because they have tasted freedom. Despite all the mistakes, despite all the faults, they know what it means to be free. What it means to voice their own demands themselves. Not to somebody who can speak French or who can speak English. In their own Creole, they know to voice their demands. And that's why so many people are fearful in Haiti. And that's why we have to unite. Because if we do not unite at this point in history, it will take us another 30 years to be able to do so. And this is going to be ugly in Haiti. I thank you for having the patience to listen to me.
Thank you very much, Raja. Our next speaker, very quickly, because he is due for another talk on another panel in Harlem, is Herb Boyd, who is a journalist, author. He's written about 13 books, and we're happy to have him here with us to talk about Afghanistan.
Thanks, Nelly. You know, it's always a pleasure. You know, Nelly calls, I come. Simple as that. And I think it's a timely situation, too. You're talking about, you know, the war. And no matter where you look, particularly with even in Hollywood, and it's not unusual that Hollywood would be jumping right into this whole game of war that's going on. Ordinarily, if you go back in time, back to the birth of the nation, in terms of dealing with the Civil War, I mean, they got it off to a very rough start to begin with in terms of the falsification of things. But we know that Hollywood has never been righteous in terms of dealing with African-American history. There's at least four movies out right now that's dealing with war. Earlier today, I went to see one, and that was Amigo by John Sayles. No relation to Bill Sayles, right? But has the same kind of politics, Bill, as you know so well, in terms of the kind of history that he has in making the kind of anti-war films, having films that really dig into political issues in this country. I remember the first film I saw by John Sayles was The Brother from Another Planet. Remember that one? Right. And then, of course, Matawan. Where's Larry Hamm? Matawan, you know, was another one of John Sayles' films dealing with the, I think, James Earl Jones, you know, starred in that one. So I just say, well, let me go check out Amigo and see what's going on with that one. And what you have with Amigo is a real foundation of American imperialism, because it's talking about the Spanish-American War with a focus on the Philippines. And we know full well, those of you, you students of the Spanish-American War, know that this is where the U.S. then, you know, challenges the whole empire of Spain and began to just tear it apart in terms of Cuba, Puerto Rico, to say nothing of the Philippines. I know in terms of looking at the Cuba situation, Buffalo Soldiers, you know, when Theodore Roosevelt had his Rough Riders, excuse me, Eve, you know, in terms of going into that situation where he said that when he was running for the presidential office in 1901, that he had to put the gun to the heads of the 8th and the 9th Cavalry in order to make them go to fight that war, which is absolutely ludicrous and ridiculous. We understand the kind of political opportunism of that time and try to placate the Dixiecrats in the South and get that particular vote. That was his reason for kind of like, A, putting this whole racist aspect out there in order to garner that vote. So you should check Amigo out, because you have the foundation there of American imperialism, you know, the whole beginning of it. Of course, you can argue about the beginning of American imperialism. You may take it all the way back to the slave trade, if you will. But certainly, this is the codification of it. And as Bill pointed out earlier, in terms of looking at Manifest Destiny, that certainly is a certification of it. You know, I'm just listening to the previous speakers, and each one of them, like Bill and I, for example, I think, 37 years ago, Bill? We were roommates in Dar es Salaam for the six-pack. That's the six-pack, which is the Pan-African Conference of 1974. This is the sixth one. And Bill was my roommate. And I was listening to him, you know, go this itemizing all of this history in terms of imperialism. Well, that's what he regaled me with almost every night. You know, hearing him talk about the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the war in Vietnam, he knew that chapter and verse. And so you got an aspect of it this afternoon. With Larry and with Milton, you know, we both have had an opportunity to be with Gil Noble. And I think particularly Milton, your essay out there, which has gone viral, has done much to alert the community to the very critical condition that Gil Noble is in. I had a chance to visit with his wife last week, and as Farrakhan said last Saturday, he had gone to visit him, and of course he was rallying at that point. They had unplugged him, he was breathing on his own, but that condition has changed. They had to plug him back in again. And at some point, the family is going to have to make a decision about this thing in terms of going back and forth, in terms of keeping him alive or what have you. But he's not breathing on his own. They had to plug him back in again. But his contribution, I've received at least 35 emails. Some of them I requested, because we're putting it together, as some of the major media do. They kind of anticipate the going of certain individuals, so we want to be ready just in case he does. But of course, our prayers are with him. And knowing him, I mean, he's a fighter right to the end. So certainly our concern is there for Gil Noble. And listening to Aisha, I was thinking about, when I hear drum, The first thing hit my mind is the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, other than the Deceased Rising Up Moving, which I think is a nice acronym for your organization, and it's certainly good to hear you. And coming after me is going to, I guess at some point, would be Glenn Ford. And Glenn has one of the most powerful essays in a book we're working on with, I'm working as an editor with Dr. Milana Karinga and with Dr. Ron Daniels and Dr. Hakeem Aldabuti. I guess I'm the only doctor, I'm the only one not a doctor on this group. And it's the book on the response to the reviews out there on Manning Marable's book on Malcolm X. Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Ours is called By Any Means Necessary with a long subtitle. And one of the most powerful essays in there is by Glenn Ford, just wrote a scintillating essay review, and along with 32 other writers, contributors that we have there. So it kind of connects me with the panel here, and of course, Nelly, certainly being with Nelly on many opportunities as it pertains to Harlem. Matter of fact, Larry, we need to get you over here and bring some of that energy and help her out here in our struggle, particularly on the gentrification issue. So the films out there, there's another film out there also called 5 Days of War. And this here, this particular film deals with what happened with the Russia's attempt to grab Abkhazia and Ossetia back into its orbit. And of course, against the backdrop of the Beijing Olympics at that time. So, I mean, Transformers, The Dark of the Moon, another aspect with Decepticons, you know, going up against Autobots and what have you. Of course, all the Decepticons are black, you know, as it would have it in Hollywood. Huh? Another film out there that, and even beyond the films, even on Broadway, where War Horse is now running. Again, you have this whole aspect of war. And there you have a play that won, I guess it was the best play, and garnered, what, 5 Tonys. So again, that war theme, even the theater, the classical theater of Harlem, has a series going on now where they're talking about war. They take it all the way back to the Greeks in terms of Sophocles and Ajax and some of the other Greek tragedies at that time, you know. So the war element is out there. So Nelly, you're right on time again in terms of talking about this theme and putting it into a global geopolitical context, I think is very important. One of the things that I'm reminded of course, is to take it all the way back to Dr. King. And it's good. I mean, in a time we talk about any concern about hooking up that war with domestic policy, domestic issues, there's no better discussant, no better prophet on that than Dr. King. And when he stood in the pulpit at Riverside a year before his assassination, he railed out, you know, against that war in Vietnam, much to the chagrin of all the other people in his organization, which told him, Dr. King, you know, stay out of international affairs. You know, you deal with civil rights. But already you can feel the trajectory of his life, that he was moving more and more, beginning to deal some very critical issues of the day and taking more and more radical and militant positions out there. And that was a very dangerous position for him to take at that time. But he was never a man of fear. And what he said there is that the amount of resources, the money that was being spent on a war in Vietnam could take care of the whole poverty situation in America. In other words, he saw a misuse, you know, of the American resources and a war he thought was futile to begin with. You know, fast forward right down to today, you know, you have the concern we have already voiced here about the misuse of funds over there. Particularly the war in Afghanistan really troubled me a week and a half ago when we lost 30 of our military personnel over there. At first they had reported that it was a helicopter crash, but then we learned later on that it was actually brought down by, you know, a rocket-propelled grenade. And of course, readily claiming that was the Taliban. Not Al-Qaeda, but it was the Taliban. But that Al-Qaeda had said something after Osama bin Laden had been taken out in May, that there would be revenge and blood And if you look at among those 30 military personnel that was killed, 22 of them were Navy commandos, and six of them, I think, belonged to the unit that took Osama bin Laden out. So I think kind of came home to me in such a way to say, well, look, let's look at this war in a way that Dr. King was talking about the war in Vietnam from a money standpoint. If you filed your income tax in a joint as a married couple and you were making $100,000 a year, something like $7,000 to $8,000 out of that went straight to the war in Afghanistan. And so you can see how it breaks down. If you have half of that, then you're making $40,000 a year, then half of that, $4,000 to $5,000, going to the war, you know, in Afghanistan. So we can see how our tax dollars, you know, begin to cry out against that. Say, wait a minute, no, you know, if we have anything to say, you know, about beyond the kind of Wesley Snipes move about our income tax, you know, and how our money is being used, and take a position on that and say, no, no, I'm going to hold back. Declare a $7,000 that I'm going to not remit, you know, to the IRS. That's what I'm claiming, you know, you're not going to get that money, and take a position on that. That would be a very interesting kind of development in terms of how you begin to move against the IRS and your tax dollars and the use of those tax dollars. Looking at that news report the other day from Atlanta about the technical college, where they had 2,000 jobs available, that line went almost across the county of people showing up looking for work. So if there's one job available, it must be at least 100 people out there willing to take it. So we're in a terrible situation that could be easily repaired. You talk about a WPA and dealing with the infrastructure in this country, you know, and putting people to work. And back in when Roosevelt did that, he called it the WPA, or Works Progress Administration, but euphemistically it was Working People of America. And they went about building all kind of bridges and parks. In my neighborhood, there's Jackie Robinson Park. That was built, you know, with WPA funds. Those workers put together many parks across the country. We're kind of waiting for, what is Obama going to do? You know, some people say, well, don't worry, he's going to pull a rabbit out of the hat. You know, just before he steps out of office, Glenn, you know, he's going to drop an executive order that's going to stun this country. So our fingers are crossed, and we're hopeful that Obama will come around, but knowing Milton, as we say all the time, the kind of centrist pragmatist that he is, and just consumed with this bipartisanship, you know, with a kind of a recalcitrant, resistant Republican Tea Party that is not at all interested in compromise, and it certainly is a dirty word for them in Washington. So Dr. King was saying that, look here, you know, our children, and it was good, Roger, hearing you talk about, you know, the situation in Haiti. You know, I've gone there 3 times over the last year, working with the Haiti Support Project with Dr. Ron Daniels. And we put together 2 documentaries. One was Cri de Coeur, Cry of the Heart, which you can see on freespeechtv.org. That's another, I work with Don Rojas there, who used to be a very important figure, Nelly, in this community, who now is the executive director of Free Speech TV. This is internet television, which of course is gonna be certainly one of the concerns in terms of the information age as we move deeper and deeper into the digital universe. But what we did down there was look at the situation in Haiti from a political economic standpoint. And again, you have these aspects of the imperialism that you talked about as early as 1914, 1915, when the US Marines went in there and essentially have never left. And in some form, they're there. Certainly the corporations that are there, it's just amazing. DuPont, for example, that has virtually wiped out the manufacturing possibility of farmers and the sisal and the whole synthetic fiber that they've created. So it just eliminates and obviates the fact that we have all these peasant farmers down there and the peasant movement, particularly in the Central Plateau. And this is, boom, the jobs are knocked out. The possibilities of them making a living with farming is just totally destroyed. Similarly with, you talk about Bill Clinton coming out of Arkansas and the provisions that he made for those Arkansas rice farmers that again undermined and undersold on the market the kind of rice production produced by the Haitian farmers. So we have this here ongoing situation where we have to be concerned about that in a contemporary way and how these manifestations of imperialism of the past rears its ugly head in so many different ways, and to pay attention that no matter, certainly from a global and geopolitical standpoint, to see how that operates. Certainly Dr. King was aware of that. I have to get to a panel over at Harlem Week. This is Harlem Week is going on, and last year we dealt with we had the children of Haiti as one of our concerns. This year we're talking about the people in Japan, what happened with them with the tsunami, the earthquake, and the nuclear crisis, subsequent nuclear crisis that hit them. So we have a number of panels that we've had going on during Harlem Week. So I have to get on over there. I wish I could stay with you a little bit longer, certainly to hear. Maybe I could stay in here, Glenn, but I have to get out of here, or Tony Montero, that's also coming up. But keep in mind that Dr. King's words are just as important today as they were back in 1967. He always said that the moral arc of the universe, you know, is long, but it bends toward justice. Well, we got to get out there and help that arc bend. We have that responsibility, that obligation. We got to bend that sucker, because what is happening with the empire, you're talking about an empire of power, you know, without compassion, an empire of